Mr. Black, Reel 8. You're in this role of moving every few weeks into various places, and this is just your troop movement as against the regimental
one. Well, troop and battery at times. I mean, in the normal way, the sort of battery moved to one particular area, and troops sort of followed on. They were scattered around a big area, but of course the other batteries of the regiment could be 50 or 100 miles away from you. Regimental headquarters could be 100 miles away. It was very, I mean, at that particular time, of course, you had the hit and run raiders on the south coast, and that was the reason. I mean, it was a deterrent, and we actually moved from Biggin Hill to New Haven, and again we weren't there very long on the New Haven on the south coast. That was where we had some really good billets in the hotels on the seafront. We were there for a little bit longer than normal. I think we were there about 5 weeks.
And did anything happen there?
There was nothing happened there. I mean, we're in 1942, and I think things had sort of quietened down then. There wasn't the raids that there was in the 1940s. I think they'd got the Germans pretty well contained as regard. There was still the occasional alarm, but while at New Haven, I remember any bombs or anything being dropped. The occasional plane came overhead, but too far away for us to take any action.
Where were the guns in relation to your billets?
Well, the guns really weren't very far away. They were along the seafront at New Haven.
And what were the coastal defences? I mean, were the beaches cut off? There were no civilians around?
Well, there were no civilians on the beach. I mean, certainly the beaches were mined, and you had the tank traps and things like that on the beaches. There were a few beaches that had been left open for the public, but there were ones that could be easily been closed. But of course, again, by that time, the sort of threat of invasion from Germany was virtually over.
You were a battery sergeant by this time?
While we're down there, I was troop sergeant.
Troop sergeant. Oh. And what are the duties of a troop sergeant?
Well, I had to see, together with the troop officers, when we moved, I had to take a couple of sites. I had to recce a couple of sites for it. So with the six guns, you had two troop subalterns, and myself. We used to take two sites each. We'd recce the sites and put the guns on the sites, and then of course I had to with the troop club had to establish the troop headquarters, the administrative headquarters for the troop, and of course when they were on site, go around visiting them and to keep sort of to let them know that they weren't out of touch. I mean, if you begin to feel like 2 or 3 miles away from your headquarters, that people forget about you. And it was amazing how it was appreciated that I did that. Generally, when I went out there, was to take out probably the cigarette ration or something like that, or a naffy ration.
So even the guns in a troop would be quite scattered.
At times they could be quite scattered, yes. It was like this when we first went with the searchlights. I mean, your nearest neighbour could be 3 miles away from you. They weren't quite as far away as that. I mean, probably within about a mile of each other, but certainly not in a cluster.
So in addition to the visits, did you have other duties, troop sergeant?
Well, I mean, you had to see to the administration, you had to see to the training. I had to give lectures on certain things, and even though we're active, more or less on active service down the coast, so the training was still very important.
Had you attended any courses during this time?
I attended course after course in the army. I seemed at one time to be forever away on courses, first aid courses, map reading courses, gas courses. I did a course on enemy armaments, in which we fired quite a lot of German, Italian heavy artillery pieces and this sort of thing. The theme being that if we captured any of these guns, we could use them. We never did, but it was quite an experience, sort of firing a big Italian naval gun after I'd been on a little popcorn gun that we had.
You mentioned gas there. Was this early on in the war that you got this gas training?
Early on, yes. Very early on, and then of course it continued all the way through, because I think the threat probably was still there. I did a gas course at Winterbourne Gunner, in which you experienced phosgene gas in the gas chamber, in which you had to take your mask off and have a sniff, and mustard gas was put on your hand to give you that experience, and you had to use the anti-gas cream on it. I mean, we've heard recently of all the ill effects of that. We had no ill effects. I mean, we weren't in sufficiently long enough to get really.
And in mid 1942, you were still carrying your gas masks.
Oh, we carried them right through the war. I mean, it was one of the last things we disposed of when we were demobbed.
So what again was happening? You've got administration work. What kind of administration work might you have to do?
Well, I mean, you had duty rosters for the various sites. You had duty rosters for the headquarters site. You looked after leave rosters. Strange enough, bath rosters. When so and so, it's your turn for to go to such and such a place for a bath. I mean, we had no bathing facilities on the sites, obviously. I mean, you could get a wash and that sort of thing. But well, there was all sorts of little bits and pieces of bureaucracy, so I would say.
It's very much like a company sergeant major in an infantry.
Yes, well, I mean, virtually it was. I mean, eventually, of course, I mean, I did become battery sergeant major, and I had the same duties, but on a bigger scale, a threefold scale. But of course, as you had other people to help you then. So.
Each gun that you were visiting, who was in actually command of one gun? Was it what rank?
It was always a sergeant, whereas with the searchlight, there used to be a corporal in control. It was always a sergeant and the guns. So I had six sergeants and had six bombardiers as well, plus probably the odd lance bombardier.
And you'd be the senior sergeant, in effect, were you?
As troop sergeant, I was a senior sergeant, yes. Eventually, when we moved to Southborough, I became... I was promoted to troop sergeant major. They made an establishment for a troop sergeant major.
Have there been any changes in your troop officers at this time?
Well, they changed fairly infrequently, actually. We had virtually the same officers, either within the particular troop or with one of our... the other troops of the battery or with another battery of the regiment. A lot of them, the officers that had been in the searchlight regiment with us, local officers.
So obviously your task would be to work very closely with them.
Oh, yes.
Need to get on well.
Yes, we did. Well, I mean, I was responsible for discipline in the battery and the troop while I was troop sergeant major.
Did you have any disciplinary problems with your battery, with your troop?
We didn't have a lot of disciplinary problems. You had the odd chap that came. Not from our own chaps that had been in the territorials with us, but you got some of the intake who thought they were a little bit more knowledgeable in the army, and they wanted to. To do certain things, or they didn't want to do certain things, and they could be a bit awkward. I only had about two occasions had to take sort of drastic action and have one of these fellas, he was actually sent to the glasshouse. He was from Scotland, from Glasgow, I think, and he was neither heck nor gee. And we tried always to reason with him. He was always getting a bit out of hand. He was eventually sent for, I think he was sent for 28 days to Colchester, and he came back a changed man.
Do you remember his name?
I can't remember his name at the moment.
Did you have any men who had family problems because they were away from them?
In early days, yes, we had one or two who, literally, they walked off the site because they hadn't heard from their families, they hadn't had any mail or anything, and they went off AWL, and they were in trouble, not great trouble. I think they got 7 days CB, but I mean, there's no difference between CB and being on the site anyhow.
Any men who were from bombed cities and were worried, concerned about
families? Well, yes, we had. I mean, we had quite at the finish. At the finish in 1942-43, we had quite a lot of people from the likes of London and Liverpool, Manchester, that they were worried about. But the worries didn't sort of stop them from carrying out their job. I mean, we would go and talk to them about it, and as long as the mail was coming through from them, they were all right. If the mail sort of dried up a little bit, that was when the worries really surfaced. But we had nobody saying, "Well, right, I'm gonna nip away because I haven't heard from them."
Was the role of the padre very important in the battery? I'm assuming you had a padre with battery.
Well, there was a padre in the regiment.
It was a regimental appointment.
Yes, we saw him very, very rarely. I mean, well, obviously he had a whole regiment. I met up with them on two or three occasions, and I always found them very good. If anyone wanted, we didn't call it counselling in those days, but the equivalent. He was always available, and we occasionally sent someone up to see him if he was within reasonable area. But again, you see, the regimental headquarters could be miles and miles away from us. He did make periodical visits around the site, and occasionally, when we got the chance, we had either a battery or a regimental church parade.
How often did you see the regimental commander? As you say, he had a great area.
Oh,
to
yes, not really very often. He did used to come round the batteries, I suppose, really when he could. But considering he had sort of 54 sites for to check on, and a regiment to run, we saw more of them, of course, when we went to Great Bounce Camp in Southborough in 1943. When the regiment was concentrated there, I mean, he was on the same, in the same camp, and we saw him daily then.
What were the lines of communication when you were in this very scattered situation? Were you on radio or telephone contact?
Well, we had the what we called the RT. If they were within reasonable distance, they put the field telephones out. We found as we're training progressed that the clusters of guns became sort of tighter, and they were within sort of telephone line distance. But other than that, there was the radio telephone,
and presumably dispatch riders.
Or dispatch riders, yes.
To come back to punishments, what kind of punishments could you give someone who misbehaved in your troop?
Well, the first one, of course, for a minor offence was he was 7 days CB, in which the thing was then he went to the cookhouse and peeled potatoes for the 7 days, and they got heartily sick of it, and that was it. A little bit more serious was a sort of field service punishment, where he was confined in the guardhouse, and then taken out so many times a day, and given a drill with full pack and marching orders by one of the drill sergeants. This didn't happen very often. I had an amusing experience about that. We'd had one of the chaps who was given this field service drill, and one of the sergeants was instructed to take him. And I was going around the camp, and I heard this shouting of orders and one thing and another. I thought, oh well, things are going well there. And I popped round the corner, and here's the chap who's supposed to do a field service drill, sitting down having a smoke, and the sergeant bawling his head off at nobody. he wasn't doing anything. I turned a blind eye because the sergeant was a friend of mine. Shouldn't have done it, but these things did happen.
You provided your own guard room and guard.
When we were concentrated in Great Bounds Camp itself, right? Yes, I mean, they had a regimental guard room there, and we also had battery guards. There wasn't a guard room as such. They used to the guard would assemble at the battery office, and it was really a patrol guard. It wasn't a regimental guard by any stretch of the imagination. We rarely had them. It was only once or twice when we were told we had an appointed guard for brigade headquarters or somewhere like that, that the spit and polish came in. We're never really a spit and polish regiment.
I was going to ask you about standard of turnout, you know, polishing uniforms.
The standard of turnout was always good, but I mean, when you went to brigade, it had to be extra good. Not as good as some of the... some of the infantry regiments that we saw. I mean, when there used to be a point what they call a stick man, and he had the soft job on the guard, and he was always the one who was the best turned out, and the things they got up to for to see that he was really turned out smart. I'm thinking now of the sort of the training camps, the infantry training camps for sort of drilling duties, and I've actually seen them bring one of their pals out who was going on guard duty, and literally carry him by the elbow so that the crease in his pants would be just spot on. He wouldn't mess them up, so he would get the good job. But they were really. They were out of our depth, I'd say, for the type of regiment we were.
Within your troops, what did you supply guards for?
Well, principally the guard was, even as the same in search sites, an air sentry. He was looking out for aircraft, and also a patrol guard going round with just patrolling the area. In the main, there were while we're in sort of camps in this country, there were stick pickets, had a big pick helve and that, instead of the rifle and bayonet as they had on the main camps and these sort of things.
We've talked about the guns, but at this point in time on the south coast, did you have the assistance of radar for early warning?
Oh well, radar was very well established then, and we would get the warning from. Well, really from brigade headquarters right down to through the regiment and troops in no time at all. And of course, you had the aircraft siren warning as well. I mean, which every time you heard it, you had to turn out whether the aircraft was in your area or not.
Did New Haven show signs of having been attacked and
not
damaged?
Not a lot. I didn't see a lot of damage there at all.
It wasn't within range of the heavy guns from across the coast?
Oh, no. I mean, I think only Dover really was the 21 miles. I mean, New Haven was quite away from it.
Where were the civilians then? Because they'd been moved off the coast, hadn't they?
They'd been moved off the coast. They weren't too far away, actually. In fact... when we were at Seaford, we were actually in billets in a house, and the civilians were still living in the house. It was a big house on the front.
What are the places where were you stationed?
Well, when we left Honiton Clyst, we went to Barnstable, and Braunton was a big, actually it was a Sunderland flying boat base, and we went there on anti-aircraft protection duties. But while we were there, we started pre-infantry training, because we were coming up to one of the horrendous parts of our training. That was 6 weeks infantry training at Haltwhistle up in the north here. But at Barnstable, it was, as I say, they had the Sunderland flying boats, and we were again on the aerodrome, had the facilities of the RAF. We had quite a lot of time off down there after we'd sort of done the infantry training in the on the dunes and not. Don't know what happened. Oh yes, we moved from Barnstable after having done that. This is where we're in December 42 now, to Sidmouth, and that's where I moved into troop headquarters as troop sergeant. And we had rather a tragic thing there when the outgoing troop sergeant disappeared, and we didn't know quite where he was. Whether there was something going on previously and I'd been brought into it, I don't know, and I didn't try to dig into it. But he went missing for about 12 hours, and then finally one of the it was one of the officers, Batman, he says I don't know whether I should tell you, but Sergeant so and so said look out for the clock striking 12 midnight. Very, very dramatic. So we just didn't know. Anyhow, we wondered what had happened. We had a check round the troop headquarters to see if when he said when something dramatic at 12 o'clock, we immediately thought, has he taken one of the small arms and is going to do something? But no, all the rifles and everything were there. And it's just at the last minute I happened to go to the box of hand grenades, and found that there was a hand grenade missing and two fuses. It's going to make sure. Anyhow, right on 12 o'clock, we heard a bang, and he'd committed suicide on the hills just outside the troop headquarters. As I say, why? I mean, he was quite a fit, active person, and what the reason was, I don't know. But he made a mess of himself. I had to go to the inquest, and it was horrific.
And do you remember his name?
Well, it was Sergeant Smith.
And you never found out why he'd got to this state?
No. There was all sorts of conjectures at the time, but until somebody can say that, right, that was the reason, I wouldn't even attempt to conjecture on it. It was actually a very sad occasion. I mean, it was my first day in the troop headquarters as a troop sergeant.
What were your duties here then? Had they changed?
No, they're still exactly the same.
And did you still get round the troop?
Yes.
So where did you go after this?
Well, after that we went. We went back towards Wormwood, which was again up by Saunton Sands, and we continued on the infantry training side. Did quite a lot of more infantry training.
What was the purpose of giving you infantry training? I know
it was an order to come out that all the field artillery regiments and every other. Even the Pioneer Corps and the engineers had to have a basic infantry instruction. I mean, I had done drilling duties courses, infantry courses, at the beginning of the war, up at Washington I did one. But this was the proper actually to take over the role of infantry, and we it's a good job we did train for it because we had to take over the role of infantry.
What form then did it take? Was it very basic infantry training?
It was.
I mean, at this point in time, before we go up to the north.
Yes. It was literally the same sort of training as you see the commandos and the Marines doing now. It wasn't sort of formal section training or anything like that. It was really getting stuck into obstacles and basically probably fitness training to get you using scrambling nets and get you going over Dunard coils of wire and various things like that. We did this sort of this section sort of training that the infantry do, but really that it sort of went, you never used it went by the board, that sort of thing, when you were actually called upon to do it.
And these are the very early stages, as you.
Yes, well, we're January 43 then, and the next thing, of course, is when we moved from there up north to Haltwhistle, to Featherston.
Did you move up as a regiment?
We moved up as a regiment. That was when the convoy came up, and that was pretty. It was January, and it was pretty horrendous. I rode a motorcycle up from Southborough, right up to Haltwhistle.
It was a road journey for the whole regiment.
No, it was a journey. So that we were an advance party. The main regiment came up by rail.
And what was your role then, as the advance party? What?
Just to prepare things at the Haltwhistle at Featherston camp, ready for them coming in.
And were you expected at the camp when you arrived?
Oh, yes.